Good evening. My name is Thomas Steininger. I welcome you to Radio Evolve, our global webcast for consciousness and culture. Today, our guest is Terry Patton. Terry Patton, many people know Terry Patton from his book, Integral Life Practice, that he co-wrote with the integral philosopher Ken Wilber. Many also know him as the presence behind Beyond Awakening, an ongoing program about living what we have realized through our deeper spiritual experiences. And Terry Patton has now written a new book, which is called A New Republic of the Heart. I welcome you, Terry Patton, and I would like to directly ask you, what is behind this title, A New Republic of the Heart?
The evolutionary trajectory of all of human civilization, it changes us. It's very hard for any of us, any conscious person who is serious about being a presence of goodness and truth and beauty and participating in the evolution of consciousness and culture, is asked to pay attention to what's really going on. And the implications of particularly of climate science, but also I think any astute observation of what's happening right now in culture and politics and society realizes that we're at a tipping point in which things cannot continue as they have been. Some people have concluded that it's going to be the unraveling of human civilization. Others have hopes that it's really going to bring on a new utopia. There are wonderful things that are happening in science and technology, and disruptive breakthroughs that are positive are kind of ahead of us, along with extreme weather events and mass migrations and the desertifications of big chunks of land and refugee flows. It's a wild time. And I think if you take that to heart, you realize that you have to become different. You step over a threshold and you want to begin to reside in a new reality. And that new reality makes you a citizen of a different nation, a different polity is the word, like political jurisdiction. And in a way, parts of our psyche and parts of our consciousness have already been arriving there in little ways. There's a whole series of insights and decisions and inspirations and commitments that take place in a person's life such that they increasingly become expressed, their life begins to express a more profound and ultimate commitment. And what I'm suggesting in a way is that that dawning commitment in your heart and in my heart is migrating us such that we're becoming citizens of a new republic of the heart. And that new republic of the heart is already visible all around us. There are literally hundreds of wonderful, worthwhile initiatives that in one way or another express the goodness and care of human beings for each other and for the planet. And yet, if you're really residing in that new republic of the heart, you're recognizing that much, much more is needed, that what you're already doing, what you're already capable of is a beginning, but it's not the totality. And so you begin to live just like a patriot feels called to make sacrifices for the sake of God and country in the old form of self-transcending heroism. You begin to feel called more and more to become, to be the change that is clearly necessary in our world, and to be pressed into the fact that you can see some of what is necessary, and yet it is more than you can see. And yet you've made a commitment to something beyond what you can describe discreetly. So that new republic of the heart is a paradoxical idea. And one of the best ways of talking about it is to use the metaphor of mycelium that mm-hmm. Shelley Sachs, who you've interviewed, introduced to me through Elizabeth, that the root system of mushrooms is called the mycelium, and it's there in the ground all the time. And sometimes the mushrooms won't bloom for several years, but the mycelium just sits there. It can sit there for many, many years. But then when the conditions are right, there are mushrooms blooming everywhere. And so there's something that is tacit, that is underground, that is invisible, that is the health in our hearts, and in, it's the way wholeness is expressing itself in each of us and interpersonally. And it will ask more of us, and it will manifest more powerfully, but it is growing. So I wanted to indicate that this new republic of the heart, in a paradoxical way, it's invisible, and yet it's already healthy. It is inevitable, and yet it needs your help. It requires a lot of you, and yet it's really something you can relax into. It's already true of you. With all those paradoxes in place, you begin to get a feeling for what I mean by a new republic of the heart.
Thank you. There's something in this short-term new republic of the heart that brings something together that I think, and I'm wondering if this is true, seems to be the core of your message. Because if you talk about a new republic, and you talked about the global crisis we are in, climate change, mass immigration, or global finance industry. The call for new republic is a very political term, the term that we do need a different form of a polis. But you call it a new republic of the heart. And here you change a dimension, and you change the dimension to something that is very personal, very intimate, and doesn't have directly a political connotation. At least it doesn't seem to. But as far as I understand you, it is particularly the connection of these two different spheres, the sphere of the politics of the republic and the sphere of our human heart, that you want to address in this new book.
That's right. In a way, one of the things that you're asked to do when you write a book is to have a very short, 1 minute or less explanation, 1 line explanation for what the book is about. And I always feel that sells the book short, but one of the best simple summaries of what this book is about is that it is about the reunification of the inner work and the outer work, the recognition that we that awakening has to get woke. You know, this term woke is used in the United States to mean woke to the political necessities. The Black Lives Matter community uses it. People are woke to racism in America, but it's also used about environmental issues. You're woke to the ecological crisis. And awakening itself needs to get woke. We need to recognize that our enlightenment has to express itself in our commitment as agents of social change. But it's also true that those who are already active and in many ways lovely people who are activists who are making a lot happen, doing a lot of good in the world, need to awaken. The transformation of the activists of us, and particularly of our relationships with each other, our ways of relating, are so crucial. We really are in a moment in which, you know, this changes everything. The ecological predicament is extreme, and the political gridlock, you know, particularly our terrible situation in the United States right now, helps us see that a comfortable life inside the bubble of prosperity that contains people in the wealthy Western democracies there's no moral dignity in simply hiding out in that reality. And that calls to us, but it calls us to something that has no limit. It has no, it is like a koan. It is an infinitely deep question that we never really emerge from. And in fact, that pressure of living that question is a big part of what will bring forward our capacities as individuals, but also our friendship. You know, like Thomas, I've come to love you partly because I have seen your commitment to this evolution of consciousness and culture to which I am committed, and our friendship has grown. And yet, instead of just praising what is good and true and beautiful in our friendship, I'm really interested in living with you under the pressure of that which is bringing forward all that is best in you and all that is best in me, and living together in the inquiry of how we can more fully fulfill the moral imperative of our time. This is a cauldron that deepens and extends and transforms our very way of being together. And therefore, a big part of what I see in this new Republic of the Heart is the evolution of human friendship and the deepening and transformation of our capacity to be communities of practice with each other.
Well, thank you for that. And you just mentioned it. What connects us also in our friendship since years is the evolution of consciousness. And you are a very prominent speaker of the integral world. And there's a particular focus how to see the integral world with the focus of the evolution of consciousness and culture, which is not necessarily an activist perspective. And there are many people out there who are activists on ecological issues, on political issues, and social issues. There's something surprising that a prominent figure like you, who really spoke a lot about integral practice, about enlightenment, about enlightenment and evolution, the evolution of consciousness, that you seem to bridge here different milieus. One which I would call the integral community worldwide, and on the other hand, a broad layer of activists who are very much interested in social change. Is that true, and why did you make this step?
Well, I found myself feeling that there was a habit, a bias of a kind among what we might call the community of awakening. And I would include in that everyone who calls themselves an evolutionary, everyone who has been a part of the integral community around Ken Wilber's work, everybody who has been involved with non-dual or really any kind of serious spiritual practice in a sangha, in an ashram, with a non-traditional teacher. This commitment to transformation comes from a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. There was a saying that I remember, from 30 or more years ago, that whenever you point your finger at someone else, at something that needs to change, remember that three fingers are pointing back at you. And I think we took that to heart, and we realized that we had to become different, that the problems we faced couldn't be solved with the kind of consciousness that had created them, and that it was a profound matter to transform our own consciousness. So we took that seriously. But there's a way that focus on personal transformation becomes self-perpetuating. We have to realize that in a way, when we made that choice, we wrote an IOU. We said, I need to change my own consciousness in order to make a difference in the larger world. That meant that we were promising to make a difference in that larger world, and a consequential difference relative to whatever it was that mattered most. And the fact that we don't know how to fully impact or even significantly impact humanity's behaviors that are pouring so many greenhouse gases into the atmosphere doesn't eliminate the fact that in some way we are obliged to live in the tension of the question, the inquiry of how can we be that? How can we contribute to the changes of consciousness and culture that would bring about a more radical change? And so living under that pressure, we begin to do many things that are not about the inner work. They are outer work. They're activist engagements. So in a way, part of my mission is to speak to people who've been involved in awakening, to tell them they need to get woke. And then the other thing I notice, though, is that it's not as though there's ever been a hard and fast line. Many, many activists have an inner life and have done some practice and some meditation. And so many of them have been wrestling with these questions in a vital way that I can learn from. And I've been tuning in to the literature and the communications of committed activists and learning a great deal. And I think that I have something to offer them, because this book goes through a pretty wide tour of the different kinds of inner work that produce a transformation in our way of being, and it integrates them in a way I don't think I've seen anywhere before. And I think that the serious reader of this book will discover that many of the insights that have been most important in their own path are knit together and integrated with a series of new insights in a way that will, I hope, liberate many people to become potent activists of a different kind, and in a way more joyful. Like, I think that we live in a society that's in denial. And so in a way, because I and my book require people to face the very depressing facts about our inconvenient, dependence, our life support system is a living planet that is way out of balance, and what it will take to become a human race that can live in a sustainable relationship with that planet is going to require radical whole system change. And what that will require of each of us is almost inconceivable. And all of that is something that people don't want to look at because they have been living in a whole culture that is in denial of those realities. And to face them is upsetting. So that seems like bad news. But what I notice is that almost everyone who is living in denial feels the way that their complicity in this consumption lifestyle, the superficial consciousness, that everyone suffers that in a subtle way. We're made inauthentic by our failure to engage. And so I think on the other side of that dark night journey of facing that terrible truth, there's actually an opportunity for a kind of happiness, a joy, a hope, a sense of purpose, a life that has beauty and authenticity of a whole different kind. And so there's actually a profound gain to the individual. And although at first it seems like a dark message, it's actually a very light-filled message. Tom, I'm not hearing you. Are you perhaps muted?
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you, yes.
Jay, you bring in your description, also when you're talking about the dark news and there's a light in this, you bring always a dimension of the crisis that our globe is in and what it means to us also in a deep spiritual culture. There's a certain integral perspective that you come from and that I find is very unique, and it brings both to the social, ecological issues, but also to the issues how we develop a spiritual people, a kind of new thinking how we can develop these two spheres together? What do you think is the particular perspective that you can bring with this integral perspective to both people who are concerned how to live a deep, spiritual, lightful life, and people who really think we have to take care that this planet survives?
You know, there's so many ways to answer that question that are all particular to the moment that an individual is in and the specifics of the way they're related to those questions. And one of the things that's sometimes useful to bring forward is the fact that this impulse that we have to self-actualize, to be all that we can be, to awaken, to self-realize, to self-actualize, that impulse seems at one level as if it's different from this other impulse to be of service, to be of benefit, to make a difference, to affect the larger world. But this impulse to be of benefit really can't be fulfilled unless we allow ourselves to be transformed. Someone who's not doing that inner work will burn out or in other ways just get in the way of their own effectiveness if they're not doing that inner work. And the person who is trying to self-actualize is going to discover that their self-actualization has to find expression in a way that makes a tangible difference in the relative world, that their awakening makes them a presence of clarity and of freedom, but it's also a presence of love, and it's a presence of love that cares all the way down, that agape cares about the living experience of people in the relative world. So the conversation will sometimes help focus people on how they can be very tangibly effective as activists, but sometimes it then becomes more personal. So this rediscovery of the invisible brotherhood that exists, you know, I was around in the 60s during the original counterculture movement, the hippie movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement and the civil rights movement. And in those years, we were just discovering both these revolutionary sides of things. You know, we would have a poster of Che Guevara or the Black Panthers in our wall, and we would go and we would demonstrate, but then we would also be reading Alan Watts or Krishnamurti, and we'd be taking LSD, and we'd be talking about new consciousness and maybe listening to Ram Dass or Timothy Leary. And yet over time, it was as if activism became its own topic, completely dissociated from awakening and back and forth. And I think that this rediscovery of a brotherhood across those two communities is critical to the survival of the human species. We have this cultural problem in the United States that people who have traditional values, who are Republicans, who are on the right, have been able to, well, to live in a post-truth environment. Maybe that was created to some degree by postmodern philosophy, but it's been exploited to the point of a kind of cynicism, really, only on the right. Whereas the people on the left are very fractious, have many disputes and things that divide them. Well, I think that there is a spiritual fragrance among the awakeners, those who've really taken seriously awakening. And there is a level of serious commitment to the well-being of other people that's alive among the activists that are each a kind of witness and opportunity for the other. Each of us need the medicine that was achieved through the years of concentrated specialization of the other group. Mm-hmm. And we're coming to a point where the crisis on the planet requires it. We don't have to have a strategy that is sufficient to the challenge in order to commit ourselves to the work. The challenge is enormous. It's so enormous that it's hard for us to conceive what's going to really make a difference. It seems impossible. And that discourages people. But I think it can actually function differently. I think it can inspire us. It can inspire us to a different kind of life. This moment of truth is a little like receiving your draft notice, telling you, report for duty. And where do you report? Well, to some degree, in a way, you're being asked to report to the revolutionary cadre in the mountains training to change the world. And in another sense, you're being asked to report to the monastery, where you need to give up your whole frame of reference and devote yourself to God and to a self-transcending life. And really, you can't be the kind of revolutionary that we're called to be without becoming a holy person. And you can't become holy except by serving in a way that gets beyond the self-focus and the narcissism that's often criticized among spiritual seekers. So this moment is a moment when we can midwife one another across those thresholds. And in the process of crossing those thresholds, we can become friends at a different and deeper level. We begin to become very humble. I mean, one of the things that has been so moving to me about the years-long process of researching and writing this book has been the deep way that I've been broken, that the ego of awakening, the fact that I've experienced some of these high spiritual states, samadhis and so forth. Well, they've been very beautiful. They've, in a sense, we might say they've reformatted the hard drive of my being. I have a whole different frame of reference than ever before. But, you know, in another way, I haven't changed anything in the outer world. My private samadhi makes not a whit of difference to the person whose home is flooded by a hurricane or whose home is burned by a wildfire. And there are going to be more and more of those incidents in the time ahead if climate science is to be believed. And I don't think we have any higher authority. And we have to let that break our stride. Being preoccupied with my own samadhi is almost morally contemptible. If I'm ignoring the larger emergency that is affecting everyone. So this recognition that we're all in a lifeboat together, this planet, this spaceship Earth, and that it's the warning lights are flashing and things are actually seemingly careening out of control and people are fighting with each other. And for us to go through this, we don't have to be sure that we can turn it around. We only have to be a presence of love and of commitment at higher and higher levels of joy, love, freedom, care, commitment. In some ways more ferocious, but in some ways more compassionate. And we have to be capable of becoming friends and being effective together that we have never understood before. And I think that there is a roadmap to doing that that integrates many points of wisdom in the spiritual path together with some of the fundamentals of what have inspired the great activists of the past. And when we realize, in a way, I mean, who do we admire spiritually? We admire people like Jesus and Gautama and Socrates. And who do we imagine, who do we admire in terms of activists? Well, similarly, we usually look to people like Gandhi and Dr. King and Nelson Mandela. And they too, they are both awakeners and activists. So there's a new kind of heroism who's not modeled on Achilles or a Marvel Comics hero. It's more modeled on St. Francis or Jesus or Socrates. And as we cultivate that, then we realize that it's even different, though. It's not that we individually would become a bigger-than-life person on whom a great historical transformation would turn. I don't have that kind of aspiration personally to be at the center of something, but I do aspire to be a practitioner who can really be a friend and a support and sometimes a mentor and sometimes a student even of others. Real fellowship, real brotherhood, real sisterhood in a sangha that could be together. You know, the next Buddha may be a sangha, you know, that saying from Thich Nhat Hanh. If we can find a way to together be practitioners in a sangha of that level of integrity and force, that's what's called for, even if it's too late. Even if the ecological predicament, which some people believe, you know, is beyond redeeming, it will matter that we go through that hospice project with as much love and care as possible, that the human species finish its experiment with its most beautiful qualities prominent. And that's what can turn it around, along with some technological breakthroughs.
If I may can come in here.
Yeah.
If I may ask in a very concrete way, people who know you from the integral world, people who are aware that it is not just about our inner experience, it's also about changing culture. It's also about changing our consciousness as culture, who are doing what you suggested them to do around integral life practice. From the perspective of the research that you did for this book in the last years, how does the integral community has to change in order to take on what you're describing here? Is there something where you say, guys, you have to join the political battle in around the world. You have to engage with what's going on with Black Lives Matter in the USA. You have to see that there is a real crisis, political crisis going on in America, but also in Europe. What is your new direction that you think the integral community has to take on in order to be more integral, more comprehensive, more what an integral consciousness really can do in these days? Hello, Terry.
I'm sorry, I was muted. There are several things. There are many things, in fact, but I can speak to a few. One of them is that we can begin to realize that the triumph of integral philosophy is not... what are the things that might be more integral about the integral community? Well, the integral community is criticized sometimes for being elitist, sometimes criticized for being too mentally focused, sometimes criticized for thinking that they're superior to everybody else, sometimes criticized for being too focused on the integral map, not applying it enough in action, sometimes criticized for abstraction rather than engagement, sometimes criticized for even qualities that are more masculine than feminine. Well, you know, there's a great saying from Gertrude Stein. She said, everybody is right about everybody. And what she means, essentially, is the same thing Ken meant when he said that every perspective is both true and partial. So the integral community definitely has a comprehensive view. It is like an eagle eye view. We can see so much more of the territory from this very powerful, you know, these five brilliant lenses of quadrants, lines, levels, lines, states, and types. It illuminates a tremendous amount. But it does make us tend to be preoccupied with our map. It does tend to to draw us toward abstraction. All those critiques have a kind of truth. Now, Ken, of course, defends, you know, because often those criticisms come from a postmodern disposition. But if we're to be a social force, we're going to have to find a way to join forces with the people who are closest to us, which includes many postmodernists and many modernists. And there's going to have to be a transcendence of our preoccupation with distinguishing ourselves from postmodernists. Often we've aligned ourselves with modernists just in order to clarify that we're not merely another New Age postmodern movement. But the real courage that will make integral more integral, and I describe this in the book, is what I call a radical integral ecology. Mm-hmm. You know, in integral theory, we sometimes make use of spiral dynamics, and one of the key terms of spiral dynamics is that a values meme comes into being because of certain life conditions. And in a time when an ecological tipping point is being reached and extreme weather events are changing the course of history, an ecological perspective, which is the postmodern opportunity, you know, becomes primary. And the philosophy of deep ecology is the fullest expression of that. The recognition that we have exceeded the carrying capacity of our planet, that we are destroying our life support system, that the intrinsic value of other non-human life forms needs to become prominent and primary. That all of that is true. Now, part of what I argue in the book is that a deep ecologist that ignores the nature of the evolution of interiors and simply argues for the non-humans in a way that doesn't appreciate the necessity of speaking to all these different structures of meaning-making, all these different perspectives that are in play, is going to be ineffective. So we need an integral ecology and a radical integral ecology. This time of crisis actually requires us to be transformed such that I am feeling now in new ways called to be a presence of love, a presence of dynamism, of care, of friendship, of fierce friendly confrontation, of to be changing my own lifestyle, to be changing my whole way of being and evolving, but not with the idea that I will be perfect, recognizing that we are all now in a time of transition in which no one will be perfect. Every one of us will be a flawed expression, but we will be perhaps practitioners who are seriously applied to a transformation of our whole way of being and the whole system of our culture and society. And that seriousness, that level of activation of our being, that transforms our whole life and our certainly our practice, but also then it will draw us into different ways of relating. And so all of the we space practices, the kinds of evolutionary dialogue that you and Elizabeth have been so dynamic in helping to clarify and lead. I even make reference to some of that in the book because I think those five principles are so useful. All of that is being called forward. So I think for us as an integral community, we kind of have to get off our sense of superiority and get into the guts of living our principles with generosity and courage and creativity at brand new levels. And I think we all have to recognize that almost everyone who's been a practitioner has been a little bit of a hobbyist. You know, we're all the beneficiaries of this privileged, wealthy, middle-class lifestyle. And yet we're now realizing that very lifestyle is what is killing our planet. So, wow, we have to change. How can we change? We can't really fully change. We're still going to sometimes get on planes. We're always, you know, going to be getting into mechanized transportation that burns fossil fuels in one way or another. This conversion of our lifestyle is a crucial thing, but there's no way that we can be perfectly pure. We have to recognize we all have dirty hands. We all have a kind of humility and compassion that we need to bring. And it's that very humility that makes us available to one another and therefore able to be part of a community that is seriously beginning to be a presence of something radically different, this new republic of the heart that I talk about.
This new republic of the heart that you're talking about, isn't it also an important part to understand that this new republic is not just a republic of North America, Europe, and the developed world? To realize, and maybe this is also something we have to understand in a deeper way, that to be really integral, we have to have a global conversation with people from very, very different cultures. And that we have to understand that our global crisis, the integral model, is something that is a very useful tool to understand different dimensions of culture, different layers of consciousness, and how they relate to how we live here in the 21st century. But their perspectives coming in, may they be from Africa, may they be from India, may they be from South Asia, that we cannot just bring in a way that basically we already know how to deal with the crisis that we are in a global way. Isn't a new republic of the heart also a republic that realizes that our conversation about all of this has to be much broader than we used to have it in the last 20 years?
Yes, it does. Exactly so. You know, in a way, Tom, we're kind of at a point in this conversation where it feels more authentic for me. I mean, I've wanted to communicate pieces of what I already understand here. Mm-hmm. And so I've talked at some length in response to most of your questions. You even had to break in at one point. But it might be even more authentic to the spirit of what this is really all about for us to do what we've done so many times and to drop into the questions together. And, you know, each of us have contemplated this matter, you know, in great depth for an enormous chunk of our lives. And so we have many partial answers at the ready. And yet what vivifies our lives and our relationship to this are the questions we're still asking. These questions are still very alive to us.
They are very alive, Terry. And I think what you are touching with what you're writing in this book is also that we have to be there for each other in a different way. One thing I'm learning right now here in Europe with the immigration crisis and mm-hmm. the new development of the populist right in Europe, that yes, there are postmodern and integral ways to understand what's going on, but there are also people who just feel to be left behind. And of course, I can have deep understandings, and they may be right and they may be true, but part of really being an activist of the heart is to really also listen to people who are, to talk about the immigration crisis, just afraid to lose their familiar homeland, their familiar mm-hmm. culture. Mm-hmm. I have answers to that. I have thoughts about that. But isn't it a big part to really be together also with those people and try to not create a division that if we just think that we have the answer already, our engagement, our political engagement will be a confrontational. But from an integral perspective, to really realize, as you said, that no one is completely wrong about their perspectives. If I translate this to a political action, that also means I have to listen and without kind of denying my own perceptions and without denying my own perspectives on this, but I have also let in that an integral perspective is always bigger than the one that I have already.
Yeah. Well, if we aren't, so, you know, one of the things that I haven't emphasized so much, because I definitely wanted this message that there's a potential for a different level of joy and purpose and inspiration and fulfillment through going here, but it's a harrowing journey. And what I do in my very first chapter of this book is to help people recognize that what we're facing are wicked, truly wicked problems, or even super wicked problems, that there will be black swan events that we can't predict, and that therefore the future is unknowable. And not only that, our attention spans and our media and our virtual lives and social media and our ways of even thinking and the way that fear affects us make all of this almost impossible for, you know, we are almost overwhelmed. From a certain perspective, it looks as though we are the consciousness of this living planet in its most articulate form, coming to an awareness of the fact that we're dooming our future and destroying our home and our, you know, grandchildren's possibilities, that if we extend the current trends forward, there's almost no hope for our future. And this is such a disorienting experience. It takes us down to the nub, and the perspectives that we have are so partial. Even our best integral and evolutionary perspectives cannot include the full complexity. We're in a dynamic that's self-accelerating, self-complexifying. The predicament is so formidable. And if we short-circuit our confrontation with that and we just orient as if we are separate individuals who have a kind of whose lives are framed just the same way they were before we saw all this, we're play acting. We're involved in a mummery, a kabuki dance, a fake version of things. So this dropping down into a deep, profound, disarmed, brokenhearted humility is the path to a new kind of seriousness and joy. But wow, it's stripped of all the egoic consolations. It's a different place to stand. And you know, I know that you've looked deeply at these things and your heart has been broken again and again. And that's why I feel I can have an authentic conversation with you, Tom. We've grieved together and we can celebrate together, but the celebration isn't a trivial self-indulgence. It's on the other side of an ecstatic apprehension of the miracle of existence, even in the midst of a larger pattern that may have its own mortality, as terrifying as that might be.
And isn't this also the other side? If we talk about bringing these two sides, let's call them people who are really deep into development of consciousness and the people who really care about social change, the actors bringing this together, that there is something that has to come from the consciousness part. I guess that's what you are pointing at when you talk about the joy, the deep joy that is needed. But there is a deep recognition that although we are in a very serious situation globally. And it's really possible that our global ecosystem will collapse. It's really not unlikely, in fact. But that in this situation, there is a dimension of life, there's a dimension of reality where it is still justified to be joyful. I had a conversation with the Benedictine monk, Brother David Stein de Rust, that you probably also know.
Yeah.
And he impressed me very much with a question. He asked me, what do you think is the most important message of the Bible? And he kind of answered it for me and said, most people say it's love your neighbor like yourself. Mm-hmm. But he said, that is an important question in the Bible. That's a very important message of the Bible. But there's one sentence in the New Testament that is there more than any other sentence. And this sentence is, do not fear. And you really made the point. The main message of the Bible, as he understands it, is do not fear. And I got really, it touched me deeply hearing this from this old wise man, because I feel this is what spiritual people have to give in this difficult situation that we are on so many social, political levels, that in spite of whatever, there's a deep reality that allows us, and you don't have to interpret it in a Christian way, you can interpret it in whatever way you want, but there's a deep spiritual dimension where in face of everything, it's justified not to fear. And that changes everything, and that changes also how we deal with someone like Trump. It's not necessarily that I have to be happy about Trump and love him that way, but there's something where hatred is not the answer, because fear is usually the foundation of hatred. And to bring this together is an unbelievable political strength that for many, that may be naive, but I think there's something that has to be brought in our political activism that comes from this answer that Brother David Stein Rust gave when he said the main message is do not fear.
I find that very moving. Anything that Brother David has to say, I always just breathe and feel and let it in. And yet, how do we relate to that injunction, do not fear? You know, there's a potential for us to just, in a way, stuff our fear under the mattress and try to go forward positively, as if it were a binary choice between fear and love. And in a way, there are some good reasons to be afraid. So we have to actually satisfy all the different parts of our intelligence and understand how fear becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And yet how we're going to live in a world in which many people are going to be afraid, and there is an infectious contagion of fear already affecting culture quite a bit. And so our choice to love instead of to be afraid has to be one that compassionately holds the parts of us that are tending to be afraid and that will be stimulated again to be afraid, such that we're going from a kind of denial-based sense of well-being that is in a way immature through a zone of facing all kinds of things that are quite terrifying to a place of well-being that is not afraid, that is developmentally includes everything that we that had stimulated our fear. And in a way, our hearts are already completely broken by everything that is terrifying. And then, yet, we're noticing the incredible gift of this moment and this day and this opportunity to have a deep conversation with someone like yourself. And the opportunity for us to live lives of incredible meaning and purpose at a time when the very character of the whole human species is going to show itself in our behavior, in our ability to embody a new kind of heroism that is really a saintly kind of heroism, a heroism more like Saint Francis and these other examples. And the thing that was present before was that it was individuals, and now it's going to be our mutuality. Like, you're inviting me onto your show is, there are different kinds of goodwill. You care about the listeners. You want to help them be fed. You care about me and the message and the work I've done, and you want it to be heard. You care about your team members who helped put this show on, and you want to help them unite together so that you can cooperate and be effective and make a difference together, so that it's not all you, or, you know, that it's a team effort. All those forms of care are expressed in this moment. And the hope is that by demonstrating that with the deepest sincerity, it will only deepen and expand and grow. And that others will be inspired by your example and by your team. This is what I'm doing too. We are, you know, to make sacred is our task in the midst of a time in which every simple answer is trumped by a greater complexity. There's always something that makes it not so simple, that makes it more paradoxical. And so we have to be in always deeper, you know, and always more present with each other and more willing to deeply listen and deeply commune.
Terry, we're also coming to the end of our hour here. And I want also to give our audience the chance to kind of connect more with the book. You have, the book hasn't come out yet. It will come out on March the 6th. You already can pre-order it though, and you have your own website for the book, newrepublicoftheheart.com in one word. And as far as I understand, you also can sign up there for a newsletter for this book. Is that right?
Yeah. What people will get if they go to that website is they'll get a PDF of the first pages of the book, including the introduction, and they'll get a MP3 of me reading the beginning of the book. And they'll get on a mailing list that will keep them updated as the work of embodying this extends. A big part of what I hope to be doing is convening conversations across the boundaries between innovators, ecologists, and evolutionaries, and among deep practitioners, so that we can have labs in which to develop our capacities more and more and more. And to develop a different kind of friendship together.
Terry, thank you very much. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for bringing this world of the inner work and the outer work together in this book. And I wish you all the best with this project, A New Republic of the Heart. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for joining Radio Wolf. In 2 weeks, we'll be on again here in our English edition. Next week will be our German edition. Thank you, and a good night here from Frankfurt.